人の罪は許してもいいと思った。
おい。
The Cutprint Film Podcast number 56 will be the Judge of Rashomon. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave and Chris.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Internet. Welcome to the Cutprint Film Podcast, episode 56. I'm one of your hosts, Jeff Rollins.
Hey, it's me, Davey San Costel.
I'm at a loss. I'm also here, and my name is Chris Evangelista.
Boy, this is going well. We are a film podcast, and yes. We talk about
movies.
Movies. New movies,
yes,
old
I got
movies.
It right.
Movies that haven't come out yet. We have a website, cutprintfilm.com, where we have movie reviews, interviews, editorials, movie news, and all that good stuff.
A lot of clicky bits.
A lot of clicky bits, whatever that is.
Click every one of our bits, won't you?
And as always, we encourage you, the listener, to go to iTunes and give this very podcast a 5-star rating and write a little blurb, if you will.
Yes. We need these reviews to raise our presence on iTunes. Right. And it truly does help because we get more and more listeners every week.
We also encourage you, the listener, in pretty much everything else you do. Just go at it.
Yeah,
do it
go
good.
Hard.
Yeah, give it the old college try.
110% like all the athletes do.
You can do anything if you put your mind to it.
Also, we encourage our listeners to write in and ask us questions that we can read on the air.
Right.
You can email us info@cutprintfilm.com. And you can say, hey, Jeff. I know that you can crush a coconut with your right hand, but can you do it with your left hand?
Yeah.
And the answer is no, not yet.
Yeah.
I've been working on it. I've been doing plenty of finger crunches and a lot of dexterity exercises, but I haven't gotten there yet.
During the whole show, Jeff is just squeezing coconuts as we're talking.
It's a goddamn mess. But the fun's over. Let's talk about movies.
Yeah, now that we got that silliness out of the way.
This was a terrible week for new movie releases, but there were a couple bright spots in the indie film arena.
That's
Dave,
right.
You want to tell us about one?
Step into the arena, Dave, with your gladiator boots.
Put on this leather tunic.
I am already wearing one under this shirt. No need. Clouds of Sils Maria.
Not the clowns of Sils Maria.
And not the clouds of Silly Maria.
Yes.
She's been put in an asylum.
Clouds of Sils Maria.
Yes.
Sils Maria is a town in Switzerland,
yes.
In the Alps.
Mm-hmm.
Just in case you're a little confused.
I am.
I saw it, Dave. I'm not confused whatsoever.
There are clouds there.
Yes.
These are about those clouds.
Yeah.
All right.
Not really.
What a boring film.
Now, who's in this film?
Kristen Stewart.
That's right.
Juliette
Binoche.
Yeah, that's it.
And Chloe Moretz.
Yes. Right. Who I didn't even mention in my review.
She's not really a big factor in the film. This is really Juliette Binoche's show.
Yeah.
You saw it most recently, so why don't you tell me a little bit about
it's,
it?
It's kind of a tough film to explain without it sounding boring.
Yeah, like the a synopsis of this film, if you would read it offhand, you'd be like, oh, I'll never watch that. But
yeah. Perhaps I'll take my grandfather to this after he dies.
Yeah, I'll wheel his corpse in and then leave it there. Because I can't afford a funeral plot.
I said to you guys, speaking of plots.
Yes, go for it.
I love it.
I said this to you guys that I didn't want to like this movie just because it sounded so boring.
Right.
But it kind of sucks you in. Like, mm-hmm. It starts with Kristen Stewart. She plays the assistant to this famous actress.
She's always on her phone, much like I am.
Yes.
There is a lot of phone stuff going on, and that's intentional. It's like, because they're going through the Alps, and a lot of the stuff has to do with, like, modernity versus the old the world.
Yeah, it's the new guard coming in to replace the old.
Which gets layered on top of itself so many times in the movie to the point where you kind of lose track of what's real and what isn't. It's cool. So the second part of the movie, the first part follows them as they're going to this like gala event of some sort famous writer.
Yeah, they're honoring him, but the writer dies before they get there.
Yeah,
he's
turns
like
out
a playwright.
He kills himself. So it's intentional that nobody knows he kills himself, but which is kind of selfish. He knows his event's about to be about him, and he kills himself.
Yeah, what a dick.
I agree.
But
has this guy ever seen those "It Gets Better" videos?
I think he was terminally ill, though. So let's cut him some slack.
Yeah,
he's not a real person, though.
Oh, all right.
Anyway, so he wrote this role for Juliette Binoche's character, which was her breakout role in a play, and then it became a film later on. Which
that's what she's most known
yeah.
for
right.
to this day.
And the play involves two characters: a young seductress and her older boss, and they fall in love, have this love affair that's toxic for both of them.
Right. And back in the day, Juliette Binoche's character played the younger. Actress in this scenario.
So the second part of the movie is her taking the role of the older actress.
They're making like a sequel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even know. Like,
or is it like a remake?
It's like a remake, but
like a remake
with
sequel
elements.
At once, sort
yeah.
of, yeah. Sort of like that Friday the 13th remake that was also a sequel.
Yeah.
And it was terrible.
Everyone enjoyed.
It's sort of like The Empire Strikes Back, but not at all.
Okay.
Oh. Well, I'm glad you brought that up.
So I don't know how deep to get into the plot because there's not that much. But a lot of it is her and Kristen Stewart working through the play yeah. in the
it's
Alps.
It's more of a performance movie. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to say the plot doesn't matter because it does, but it's more the joy of this film is seeing Juliette Binoche and Kristen Stewart's performance and how they act together. And
yeah.
That, you know.
Yeah, and it's cool because it shows celebrities in this way that you don't normally get to see them portrayed. Like...
cannibals. Sorry, it's a different movie. There's no cannibalism in this.
No.
It's from their perspective, so you kind of feel bad for them with the paparazzi and stuff like
right,
that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, they're making fun of the paparazzi, but then throughout the movie, Juliette Binoche keeps looking up like things about Chloe Moretz's character on the internet. It's
yeah.
just like all gossipy yeah. stuff. So it's very hypocritical and contradictory. And how do you say her name? Chloe Moretz?
Chloe Moretz, yeah. That's yeah.
It's spelled weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's got a little umlaut, I believe, in there somewhere.
Yeah, and she's...
It's Chloe with a V.
Her character's pretty hateable in this.
Yes.
Like, but she... It's played very well. I'm kind of upset that I couldn't find a way to talk about it in my review, but it just didn't...
She's a fairly good
yeah.
actress, I would say.
But Kristen Stewart is really the standout.
Yeah, Kristen Stewart has been having quite a big... I'm not going to say comeback, but it's sort of like she's proving that she's more than just the
yeah.
actress from Twilight. And
this was the first... film I had seen Kristen Stewart in where she really wowed me as an actress.
Right.
I saw this at the Philly Film Festival last October. So I saw this before I got to see Still Alice, where she was incredible.
She's
in that.
Really good in that.
And she's also really good in Camp X-Ray, which came out last year.
Right. I've yet to see that, but I hear she's good in it.
She has a very... It's weird because she almost plays the same role in all those movies. Like, she's great in these, but she's still playing.
Yeah, I don't think she has
Kristen Stewart.
I don't know if she can play like a wildly different character,
yeah.
but
yeah.
she's really good at doing what she does.
Yeah,
she has a very like naturalistic sort of.
It's the Tom Cruise effect, I think.
Yeah,
Tom Cruise always plays the same version of Tom Cruise, no matter what he's in, but
right.
it's enjoyable
yeah.
because you know it's something that nobody else is
yeah.
doing.
Thank you, LRH.
Yes, this.
Kristen Stewart salutes a photo of
a giant portrait.
But she's great in this. I don't know what else to say about the movie other than I found myself like thinking about it a lot after I saw it.
Yeah.
Like I kept going over and over these certain scenes and trying to figure out because there is a bit of a mystery to it and it leaves you in this really ambiguous kind of like
yeah.
it's a conflicting feeling at
mm-hmm.
the end.
Yeah.
I had watched two terrible movies back to back. I watched a movie called The Harvest, and I started to watch a movie called The House Across the Street.
Didn't you start The Burning Dead, too, at one point?
Oh, yeah. I also started The Burning Dead, and all of these movies were very bad. And then I turned The House Across the Street off and started Clouds of Sils Maria, and I was like... It was like a breath of fresh air to see a film so well made.
Yeah.
Like right from the start, this movie is so well made and so well acted. I'm like, oh my God, I forgot there were good movies.
And incredible cinematography,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, just gorgeous. And it's like, it was like I was crawling out of a bomb shelter after the nuclear blast went off. I'm like, oh, there's still flowers.
Yeah, it's like those scenes when they're getting back into the spaceship and there's no oxygen in that room and they finally hit the button and it fills up. And
this is a different film.
Yeah, I was very confused what's going
this
on.
This is an analogy
oh, okay.
what Chris felt.
I thought you were talking about a scene in Sils Maria where they get in the spaceship.
That
I must
be
have been
awesome.
I must have been getting a refill in my large popcorn bucket. I missed that part.
Your golden bucket.
Yes.
So yeah, Clouds of Silver. Is that on demand or is it only in theaters?
Ooh, I think it's only in theaters.
Okay, yeah. So
and it hasn't released in Philly yet, has it?
No.
Find your local art house theater in a back alley, perhaps, yeah. And see this film.
Be careful, though. Tell someone where you went.
Yes.
Lest you disappear forever.
Yes, bring a chaperone. But another film that came out that is on VOD is the long-delayed Lost River, directed by Ryan Gosling.
Yes, and this has had a storied production.
So was it delayed?
It will, I don't know if delayed, it just never got a release, basically.
Okay.
So it premiered at the Cannes Film Festival over a year ago, and it did not perform well. Audiences booed the film, I believe.
They put it in the can, if you know what I mean.
Yes, the rubbish bin.
And they sure did.
Yes. They did not like it, and at that point, the film had already been purchased by Warner Brothers, but after the terrible reception,
their WB's pulling their collars.
Yeah,
like,
Michigan J. Frog was not happy, and so
they cooked him alive.
So the film just sort of sat on the shelf for a while. It shat the bed and sat on the shelf for a while, and eventually they finally, now in this year of 2015, in April, they gave it a very limited release. I believe it opened in 3 theaters total.
Limited release, no marketing campaign whatsoever.
Yeah, there was no marketing except on Twitter, I guess, if you want to count that.
And very similar to the animated film Strange Magic, which came out in February to no one's
yes.
awareness.
So, yeah, but it came out, and I reviewed it for cutprintfilm.com. And, I don't know. Maybe I'm just I'm an easy lay for some Ryan Gosling. But it's not anywhere as bad as people made it out to be. I won't say it's a great movie. It has problems. But I don't know. It's about it's very like in this hyper stylized. Mm-hmm. Where it reminded me a lot of Only God Forgives, which Ryan Gosling was in, obviously directed by Nicholas Winding Refn. It's very much inspired by that sort of.
Yeah, and they're very close.
Right.
I'm sure everything he learned about directing, learned from.
Pretty much, he's like ripping it off.
Yeah.
It's a regular meat and potatoes type film.
Yes. It's weird and it's delightfully weird. I mean, it's set in Detroit and it has that same sort of like haunted, crumbling Detroit quality that It Follows had, which I liked that. And Christina Hendricks plays the single mother. She's raising one son who's sort of like a teenager and then another son who's younger. And she has no job and she needs to make money. And so this guy who's a bank manager, played by Ben Mendelsohn, who is a great character. He's on that show Bloodline.
He was in Place Beyond the Pines,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. He's one of those actors, you always see him in things, and he's always like, oh,
he's a very good actor.
But also in the deplorable heist film, it's actually escaping my name. That's how I went to sleep immediately after I saw it and wish I never woke up.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You're not talking about Place Beyond the Pines, are
you?
No.
That's also he's also in The Dark Knight Rises. He's in all these
He's in an episode of Girls.
That's where he really shines.
But he's a very good actor.
He's phenomenal.
He reminds me of Gary Oldman. Like,
yeah, he's got that Gary Oldman sort of thing. And even one of our writers, Josh Oakley, pointed out that he has that sort of Philip Seymour Hoffman thing going for him, where he's a character actor who's so strong that he can just carry a film.
Yeah, I would love to see him in larger roles.
Yeah, so he's in the film. He's the best part.
Like Darth Vader.
Killing Them Softly is the film I'm talking about.
Oh, with Brad Pitt, yeah.
Yes, not good.
I forgot he was in that.
Everyone did.
But
I'll defend that movie, Killing Them Softly.
Let's talk about that another time.
We'll have to have a shootout later.
Ow!
So Ben Mendelsohn, he gives Christina Hendricks' character a job in this sort of like burlesque show, but it's this weird sort of Grand Guignol. How do you say that word? You know that word I'm talking about?
No.
All right. It was this French theater.
Toblerone bar?
Yes. It was this French theater where people put on plays about blood and guts.
Je suis? Is that what you're thinking?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. So anyway,
tête.
It's women on stage pretending they're getting murdered, and it's just this weird... Oh. Cool.
No wonder you liked it.
Yeah, that's my sort of thing. Like, there's literally a scene where Christina Hendricks, she's on stage, and instead of stripping, she cuts her face off and then peels her face off, and then the crowd goes wild.
I've seen that clip on the internet.
And I don't know. It's a weird movie. It's entertaining. It's not, it's not mind-blowing. It's not going to change the face of cinema.
What do you think the issue is with it, then? Is it just Ryan Gosling? Like, people want to take him down a peg?
I think it's sort of that Ryan Gosling, he exists in that borderline where he's in the mainstream, but he also makes art house films. So I think it was sort of, oh, a new Ryan Gosling film that he's directing, and it's so weird, and it's so maybe derivative, I guess is a word, and so, I don't know. People, it didn't fly with people.
But what if it was, like, do you think if this had premiered and it was, like, Clark Bennington, like, someone you've never heard of?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's well-made.
People would have been like, oh, wow, this is somebody to keep your eye on.
I guess, I don't know. I feel like even if you don't like the film, you have to appreciate that at least Ryan Gosling went out there and tried something. Because, yeah. I don't know, Joel Edgerton, the actor, has a movie coming out called, like, The Gift. And the trailer for that is the most cookie cutter, by the numbers thriller bullshit. There's no like art in it. At least like Ryan Gosling tried something. Yeah. You know, you got to give him credit for that.
Is it better than Sean Penn's movies?
Depends on which one.
Into the Wild.
Yeah, I would like. I like this more than Into the Wild, but I don't like Into the Wild.
What about Sean Pencil's movies? Is there anything like that? Let's move on. Nobody addressed that.
I was trying to think of more like handwriting puns with Sean Penn's name, but everything escaped me.
Sean Penmanship?
Yeah, yeah, that works. Right. Okay.
Well, anyway.
Now that we've exhausted that trope.
Now that we've run all the good Sean Penmanship jokes into the ground.
So, I mean, the box office was topped off by Furious 7 again, followed by Home, and then, you know, a bunch of stuff that has been out or...
Yeah, I mean,
we're not going to talk about.
There's nothing, literally nothing in the top 50.
Everybody's afraid to release stuff until the Avengers comes out.
We're slowly creeping our way towards the Avengers release, which will obviously be the biggest opening for a while.
Yeah, we'll start our summer.
Clouds of Sils Maria opened in three theaters with a box office take of $70,000.
All right, then.
Yeah, so that's the big indie news this week, everyone.
I mean, I wouldn't poo-poo that. I would take $70,000.
I would, too.
Yeah,
hand it over. Mm. All right, what are we going to do? We're going to go to break.
We're going to come back. We're going to start a new director in our director series.
Yeah, right. Mel Brooks. Everyone's been waiting for it. The return of the Mel Brooks director series.
And all three films are Life Stinks.
I'm sorry. I got the wrong memo.
Akira Kurosawa.
That's who we'll be talking about.
Director of Life Stinks.
That's incorrect, Chris.
Akira Dead and Loving It.
Yes. Yeah, we'll be talking about his 1950 film, Rashomon.
And we'll be right back.
Ah, come forth and let me tell you the tale of CutPrintFilm.com, a film review, editorial, and news website.
Have they got any loot there?
They do. Oh, I can't find it. Does anyone know where the loot is?
I have one right here.
Cutprint Film has a merry band of men.
Do they drop the beat?
Yes, they do. It includes More Like Radio, Joystick Jerks, and Anti-Fanboy.
Lemons, lemons, lemons.
It is working.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
What?
This is the song my wife and I first danced to at our wedding.
Yeah, you took off your shoes and danced in the gym.
We cut a rug.
The old sock hop.
Yes. Well.
And you went for a malted. Jeff's a time traveler, and so is his wife, I guess, in this scenario.
We went to our local soda jerk. All right, so this is our director series. We're starting a new one on Akira Kurosawa.
That's right, and as always, I tell you, our director series...
Who is Akira Kurosawa?
Wait.
Nope.
I have to introduce the director. There's a form. All right.
Wait, don't we have to play something first?
No, I have to say what it is first.
Oh. You're jumping the gun. Someone's excited.
Dave, I know it's the first time we've done this, but so the director series is a thing on the show where we pick a director and then we pick three films from that director and we talk about those films over a series of three shows.
Yes.
And as always, we encourage you, the listener, to write.
Call in.
Or write in and pick a director for us to focus on.
Yeah. Like I said, we're doing Akira Kurosawa, and we're starting off with his 1950 film, Rashomon. But first, let me play this piece of production here.
It's the Cutprint Film Director Series.
Action!
Directors!
Pass the popcorn. Put a piece in my mouth.
Excellent. I loved it.
sounded very enthused about that.
Yes, all right. So, Chris, you have a little intro on Mr. Kurosawa.
That's right. And let me just preface this by saying, please forgive me for my dumb American pronunciation of people's names, because I'm a stupid, uncultured American.
It's going to be a little rough for all of us.
So, just forgive us our trespasses.
Yes. And
as we forgive those.
Yes. All right. The most well-known of all Japanese directors, the great irony of Akira Kurosawa's career is that he became far more popular outside of Japan than in. Kurosawa studied art before gravitating to film as a means of supporting himself. He served 7 years as an assistant director to Kajiro Yamatoto before he began his career, his own directorial career, with the film Sanshiro Sugata in 1943. Following the end of World War II, Kurosawa's career gathered speed with a series of films that cut across all genres, from crime thrillers to period dramas. His film Rashomon became the first post-war Japanese film to find wide favor with Western audiences, and simultaneously introduced leading man Toshiro Mifune to Western audiences. In later years, despite ill health and problems getting financing for his more ambitious films, Kurosawa remained the most prominent of Japanese filmmakers until his death in 1998. With his westernized style, Kurosawa always found a wider audience and more financing opportunities in Europe and America than he did in his own country.
All right, very good. Kurosawa is the first foreign filmmaker that we're touching on in our director series.
Right.
If you don't count David Cronenberg.
Who is, Canadian.
Yes.
And eats Canadian bacon at all times.
That's what they do.
Before I decided on Kurosawa, I just watched Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill again. This was a couple weeks ago. And I was just like, oh my God, I got to see where this came from. You know what I mean?
The blueprints for Tarantino.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have a plot synopsis. This is it's an 88-minute film. It's, very trim, but...
That's surprising to me that it's such a that so much happens in such a small amount of time.
This film accomplishes more in 88 minutes than most 2.5-hour films can even dream of accomplishing, with bloated budgets and big stars, whereas this is a black-and-white film with two locations it's set in. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So the film opens on a woodcutter and a priest sitting beneath the Rashomon City gate to stay dry in a downpour. A commoner joins them, and they tell them that they have witnessed a disturbing story, which they begin recounting to him. The woodcutter claims he found the body of a murdered samurai 3 days earlier while looking for wood in the forest. Upon discovering the body, he says, he fled in a panic to notify the authorities.
Sure he did.
Hey, don't tell me now. Spoilers.
The priest says that he saw the samurai with his wife traveling the same day the murder happened. Both men were then summoned to testify in court, where they met the captured bandit Tajimaru, who claimed responsibility for the rape and murder. And from there, we get three different accounts.
Right.
And it's shown during the testimony of the trial. So these actors are talking to the camera.
Yeah, it's almost as if we, the audience, are the judges.
Yeah, and it's just one of many incredible touches.
Yeah, I kind
of
love that, how you never hear
the judges talk.
Yeah, you never even see the judges. Yeah. You're just...
Well, you are the judge.
Yeah.
You literally are.
Right.
It's like you're the judge.
Yes. Does anybody else want to say the exact same thing?
Good one, Dave. How'd you come up with that?
Okay, so the bandit story goes like this.
Smokey and the Bandit.
Yes. Tajimaru, played by Toshiro Mifune, a notorious bandit, claims that he tricked the samurai to step off the mountain trail with him and look at a cache of ancient swords that he discovered.
Man, if I had a nickel for any time a bandit did that to me.
It happens every weekend.
I'm just driving
now. When that happens, I'm like, oh, he's just going to tell him to fuck off. And then it cuts to him following him through the woods. Like, I got to see these swords.
I love swords.
Yeah. Ooh, a cache of them, you say.
In the grove, he tied the samurai to a tree and then brought the samurai's wife there. She initially tried to defend herself with a dagger, but was eventually, quote-unquote, seduced by the bandit.
How could you not be?
Exactly. Yeah. He had no shirt on.
He's laughing.
The woman, filled with shame, then begged him to duel to the death with her husband to save her from the guilt and shame of having two men know her dishonor. Tajimaru honorably set the samurai free and dueled with him. In Tajimaru's recollection, they fought skillfully and fiercely, but in the end, Tajimaru was the victor and the woman ran away. At the end of the story, to the court, he is asked about an expensive dagger owned by the samurai's wife. He says that in the confusion, he forgot all about it, and that it was foolish for him to leave behind such a valuable object. Okay, the next account of the story is the woman, the samurai's wife.
We'll call this Chris's story.
Why would we call it
that? Why would we do that? Am I the samurai's wife? I don't know.
Am I the bandit?
I'm the samurai.
All right.
Well, obviously, you're the most skilled here.
So the samurai's wife story goes like this. She says that Tajimaru left after raping her. She begged her husband to forgive her, but he simply looked at her coldly, much like I look at David when he makes inane comments.
That's when I was watching this film, that scene where the samurai just gives his wife this icy stare. It was like looking at Jeff while we're doing the podcast when he looks at Dave.
She then freed her husband and begged him to kill her so that she would be at peace. He continued to stare at her with a look of loathing.
Again, like Jeff at Dave.
It does just go on for like minutes. You're like, oh my God.
Much like my hour and 20 minute stare that you have to gaze upon
every
week.
Show.
His expression disturbed her so much that she fainted with dagger in hand. She awoke to find her husband dead with the dagger in his chest. She attempted to kill herself but failed in all her efforts and fled.
Typical. So,
yeah, sure she did.
The third story is the samurai's story.
Dave's story.
But wait, how? He's dead.
Well, since this takes place in, is this 16th or 17th century Japan?
I'm not 100% sure.
They don't say, but there's civil war erupting all around them, so I'll assume it's 16th century.
Well, the civil war was, I believe, the 1800s.
That's a different country.
I'm actually dead, and there's a medium here talking in the microphone.
Yeah, so what happens is they believe in spooky ghouls, and the dead samurai story is told through a spiritual medium in one of the greatest sequences I've ever seen on this film.
Can I get that spiritual in a large, perhaps?
Oh, man.
Oh, you were waiting the whole show for that.
That was good.
But yeah, the medium scene is fantastic. And it's eerie.
Yeah,
it's the voice.
It's this woman who burns incense or some type of material.
She flails around.
Yeah, she's flailing about, and the film is sped up so that the burning incense is, it looks like it's fast forward burning. It's really incredible looking.
Her voice is like through some
her voice
kind
is
of
his
modulation.
Voice.
Yeah, it's the actor that played the samurai's voice coming through her mouth as her mouth is talking. It's really unsettling.
Yeah, they distort it somehow. It sounds weird.
Yeah,
it's like tinny. Like it's
so. The samurai's story goes like this. He claims that Tajimaru, the bandit, after raping his wife, asked her to travel with him. She accepted and asked Tajimaru to kill her husband so, again, she would not feel the guilt of belonging to two men. Tajimaru, shocked by this request, grabbed her and gave the samurai the choice of letting the woman go or killing her.
Oh, God, that's like that's when the best line in the movie comes, when he's sitting there tied to the thing and he's like,
"For these words alone," the dead samurai recounted, "I was ready to pardon his crime."
Yes.
Man, that's cold.
Yeah.
The woman fled, and Tajimaru, after attempting to recapture her, gave up and set the samurai free. The samurai then killed himself with his wife's dagger in an honorable death, and later, somebody unknown removed the dagger from his chest.
But who was it? Who took the dagger?
Well, Dave, after all these accounts at the trial are retold, the woodcutter that we then cut back to the framing device of the film under the Rashomon Gate, and the woodcutter says, "Well, actually, back at
you might be a redneck." If
he said, "Well, actually, I didn't just see the dead body. I witnessed the entire thing happen. I just didn't want to get involved."
Oh, that would be me. I would totally do that.
Yes, and
like, Chris, did you see a murder?
And that's part of the point here that Kurosawa was making. The woodcutter actually witnessed the rape and murder, but he did not want to get involved at the trial. And according to the woodcutter's news story, Tajimaru begged the samurai's wife to marry him, but the woman instead freed her husband. The husband was initially unwilling to fight Tajimaru, saying he would not risk his life for a spoiled woman.
What a jerk off.
Yeah. But the
I see this point.
But the woman then criticized both of them, and Tajimaru saying they were not real men and that a real man would fight for a woman's love.
That's right. That's how I won my wife's heart.
She spurred
you the are
men.
The wife, though.
Oh. What? Oh, this again?
No, we're letting that go, Dave. We're not talking about that.
She spurred the men to fight one another, but then hid her face in fear once they raised their swords. The men, too, were visibly fearful of one another as they began fighting.
That's great, too, because in the bandit story, their fighting is very skillful. They're just like rolling
they're
around.
Stumbling
they're
stumbling a bit.
They're Mo Howard and Larry Fine. They began a duel that was much more pitiful than Tajimaru's account had made it sound, and Tajimaru ultimately won through a stroke of luck. After some hesitation, he killed the samurai, who begged for his life on the ground, and the woman fled in horror. Tajimaru could not catch her, but took the samurai's sword and left the scene limping. And then at the climax of the film... Yes, there is a...
the magic baby.
Yes, a magic baby appears, and it interrupts the priest and woodcutter and the commoner's story, and they find the baby abandoned in a basket. The commoner takes a kimono and an amulet that had been left for the baby, and the woodcutter reproaches the commoner for stealing from the abandoned baby, but the commoner chastises him. Having deduced that the reason the woodcutter did not speak up at the trial was because he was the one who stole the dagger from the scene of the murder, the commoner mocks him, a bandit calling another a bandit. The commoner leaves Rashomon, claiming that all men are motivated only by self-interest. These deceptions and lies shake the priest's faith in humanity, but he is brought back to his senses when the woodcutter reaches for the baby in the priest's arms. The priest is suspicious at first, but the woodcutter explains that he intends to take care of the baby along with his own children, of whom he already has six.
Yeah, and he says, I have six. What will one more do? Yes. And I'd be like, I will leave this baby.
I'd rather get rid of five of them.
How does that restore your faith in humanity, too? Because he's really just like, I already have a bunch of kids. Yeah. I'll take this one,
That's
too.
One more laborer. This simple revelation recasts the woodcutter's story and the subsequent theft of the dagger in a new light. The priest gives the baby to the woodcutter, saying that the woodcutter has given him reason to continue having hope in humanity. And the film closes on the woodcutter walking home with the baby. The rain has stopped and the clouds have opened, revealing the sun, in contrast to the beginning of the film where it was overcast and pouring rain.
Love that rain.
Yeah, and that's the entire plot of Rashomon.
Right.
So let's talk about these three disputed stories.
Yes. Well, the film, the opening fucking shot of that guy running across the water and the destroyed temple. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's in like insane disrepair.
Yeah. And the rain.
It was just like, I felt this feeling of like, oh shit, like I'm going to be in love with this. Mm-hmm. And not only this, but now I'm going to have to watch every Akira Kurosawa movie. And this is going to now be a thing in my life. I felt all of that just in this first opening 10 minutes. and it was kind of strange.
This film's on YouTube because it's in the public domain. But did either of you watch the Criterion version?
The one on YouTube actually is the Criterion one.
Okay, I didn't know that because it's absolutely stunning looking. They did an incredible job of restoring this film that came out over 50 years ago.
Yeah.
It looks beautiful. And that rain is so... It's unsettling, and I looked it up. It's actually the water's dyed black, and it's poured onto the gate and onto the set from fire engine ladders.
Wow!
Oh, wow! Yeah. I would love to see a picture of that panned out.
It would be incredible. But they had to dye it black because it wasn't picking up the severity of the downpour as much as Kurosawa wanted. So, but yeah, you're right. The film itself looks incredible. Everything about it, this framing device of the Rashomon gate, where I guess you can assume that there's dead men hanging above it. And they dropped this line that an evil spirit left the town because it was so disturbed by the acts of man.
And you're seeing the film takes place much earlier in time, but this is 5 years after the destruction of Japan in World War II.
Mean when the film was released?
Yeah. It's when they're filming it, you know what I mean? And it's clearly referencing that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. This whole thing's an allegory for the post-war defeat of Japan. And I think that's kind of what endeared it to American audiences because it...
But that's
instead of the Japanese being this other, this unknown other, it shows them in a humane light that they're actually self-referential. They're self-referential of their acts leading up to the war, during the war, and then, you know, what happened to them at the end of the
war.
It's
just crazy that you get that feeling right from the opening of the movie. You're like, oh, World War II happened, and this, it's
obvious.
So much,
And it's heavy, and it's beautiful.
And not just the rain, but then there's a great use of light that occurs out. It's a sort of Robert Altman referred to it as a dappled light, and I love that it's not just a straight. Like, there's a great interview with Robert Altman where he's just talking about the film, and he was saying, like, if the film had just been shot on a clear, sunny day, it would not have the same effect, where just this, the light, it's always coming in through, like, the leaves on the trees, and it's always just not 100% clear, and it gives everything, like, a dreamy sort of quality.
Yeah. He actually films the sun directly, points the camera at the sun through the grove of trees. It's insane looking. It's gorgeous.
And like, apparently no one had actually ever done that before in film until this. Like, this was like the first time anyone was like, let's point the camera at the sun.
This film does a lot of firsts. Like, he bounced light with mirrors, which people had never done before.
Yeah, but he was so obsessed with using natural light, much like Kubrick was in Barry Lyndon, that, like you said, he used mirrors to bounce the actual sunlight into these shady tree groves to... I read that the light was meant to show when a character was, you know, doing something sensible, coming to their senses, and shadows were used when a character was doing something impulsively and acting on impulse. And when you look at the film that way, after knowing that, it makes a lot of sense, because every impulsive action, every, you know, misdeed a character does, they are cast in shadow.
Yeah.
But just like those shots of like the grove and the light bouncing, and you could tell where the light's coming from, but then it's bouncing into the middle of the grove, and it gives it like this fantastical quality, because there's, you know, the sun light shouldn't be where it is.
There's that one shot where the bandit, he's like up on a clearing, he's looking down, and you see the samurai's wife, and she's all in white, and she's just like a ghost in the center of the frame. That like took my breath away, that scene. Just it looked gorgeous.
This whole film, I think, is gorgeous.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, there's also the analogy of, you know, this commoner during the framing device, he's pulling apart pieces of the gate to burn.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And Kurosawa was using that to make a comment on, you know, taking down the old Japan and coming into sort of like the World War II, post-World War II effect. Kind of taking down this construct of what you think it means to be Japanese, and we're moving into a new era, and this is what Japan is now.
Yeah, that ties into like the whole overarching theme of judgment, like Japan kind of judging it. I mean, you're judging Japan as the viewer.
So let's talk about that now.
Yeah.
Okay.
The conflicting stories here, because that's the meat of this film.
Yeah.
The ham.
The Rashomon effect,
yes.
Which it later went on to be called, because this was the first time like we had seen this narrative structure of conflicting stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so many bad movies steal it.
And apparently they use it incorrectly, because you'll get the true story at the end, but in the actual Rashomon, we never find out the truth.
Yes, plenty of episodes of Law and Order use the Rashomon
dun, dun.
Effect.
So... Yeah, the bandit story, he's just like a whack job.
Well, the performance, I wanted to, before we get into the, I just want to say that a lot of times with foreign films, I have a difficult time judging a performance, just because I don't speak the language.
Yeah.
So it's hard to tell. But the performances in this are, I don't know, they're so good. And like, I found this performance alone, of Toshio Mifune.
He's incredible.
It's fantastic. It's just like...
Yeah.
Electric. He's just like constantly moving and twitching, and I don't know.
His performance and the wife's performance are probably the two best.
Yeah.
Because she shows such range, because in every story she's a different character.
Yeah.
And the bandit is doing a lot of, it's sort of like class before there was sound and pictures. He's doing a lot of wild motions with his body and his mouth. He's laughing heavily when he, you know, probably shouldn't be laughing, just to show that he's sort of mad. He's a wild card.
Yeah, because Kurosawa said he made this as like an ode to silent film.
Oh, okay.
So,
well, then that makes a lot of sense.
A lot of the stuff is choreographed
and it's
to not need the dialogue.
And like, I feel like another actor doing all that would fucking annoy the shit out of me, but it didn't.
That is a good point. Like, his crazy laughing, even though it, like, comes off as annoying, it doesn't annoy me.
It's supposed to be annoying in the context of the character, but never once where I was just like, all right, stop doing that, as I tend to be with other actors.
And this was a hit with American audiences. Right. And here's the crazy thing. When this came out in 1951 in America, they didn't get subtitles. They got a dubbed version.
Oh.
So this was a hit even with dubbed American actors speaking in a Japanese affected.
I almost want to see that.
Comes on the Criterion release.
It does.
It's
just
available.
To, like, reference the two together.
If you're going to be a purist, I guess that would be the way to watch it, because that's how American audiences first fell in love with this movie. But I'm a subtitle guy.
If I was a character in this, I'd be called the purist. So
I can think of another name for you. The asshole.
I didn't want to know. I looked away.
Yes, Dave did actually look away as I was getting ready to spit that at him.
Dave smudged his painted-on eyebrows as he buried his hand in his head.
So let's let's get to these conflicting stories. Yes. First, we get the bandit story, and
no, we get the wife story first.
No, it's
get it. We got conflicting stories already.
This absolutely stinks.
I just threw something at Dave because of that.
Our audience has turned the podcast off. The bandit story is that he tricked the samurai, and he fell in love with this wife character, right?
Right.
And
Who wouldn't? She had that big hat on.
She did.
Like Lord Raiden.
Well, she did look like Lord Raiden.
Yes, the god of thunder and lightning.
And,
test your might.
Yes, test your might indeed. So what did everybody think of the bandit story?
I love that each person who tell, because they're telling this before a judge and jury.
Yes.
We assume they are. But each person who tells the story, aside from the woodcutter, takes responsibility for the death at hand.
Yeah,
that's
really,
a very
I
interesting
that.
Thing.
Like, there's no, like, they're not trying to. I mean, I guess there is a sort of passing the buck thing in that they all, in some way, blame the wife the most. It's always like her fault, but that just ties into the culture of both the film when it was made and the era it was set in. But yeah,
and I will say though that when the wife tells her story, she gets that great was that the wife's story where she puts them both in their place? No,
that's
that,
the woodcutter,
that's
one
the woodcutter
the
story. I love that, because even though the wife is considered this immoral woman for most of the film, she does put these two pieces of garbage in their place.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like, because you're...
Which I wasn't expecting, especially for a film made in 1950, Japan.
It was so... That was
fairly
so refreshing.
Yeah.
Because the whole movie, you're waiting for that to happen, and you're not expecting it to. Yeah. You're like, man, I wish this lady would just, like, snap. And then she does, and you're like,
this is
wow,
great.
Like
you said, you're not expecting them to actually do it, but you want it so badly. And so when they do it, it's great. But, the bandit, he paints himself in the, best light.
He's the best bandit in town.
Yes, he's a rapscallion.
Yeah.
And then the wife tells her story where she is the pitiful victim of both of these awful men.
The priest actually says that, doesn't he? He's like, I never, like, all the ferociousness was gone that he talked about. She was just so pitiful.
Yeah.
When the bandit tells his story, he says, like, the one reason he's so drawn to the wife is that she's feisty. But in her story, she's not feisty at all.
She's this wallflower.
Yeah.
But and then
he does blame it on a cold wind, though. I like that scene.
Oh, yeah.
Where he's sitting there against the
tree. He's, like, napping in the woods, as bandits oft do.
But then we get my favorite story, which is the samurai's story as told through
the ghost story.
And not only do I love the scene, which I already said, but I love that I can't tell if this is the actual samurai telling the story and wanting to paint himself as honorable because he gives himself the samurai's death via his own dagger, or if this is the medium telling the story.
He's making it up.
Because, she's selling a service here and she has to make herself, seem realistic, even though this is spooky ghoul stuff.
You can read it that way. Because she's reinforcing the old ways, but
right? The myth,
samurai's
the myth
death.
Of the samurai. Yeah. She has to hold up this construct of this, you know, honorable warrior.
Yeah.
So I love that you can either take it as yes, this is actually the samurai telling his story through the ghoul world, or if it's the medium, yeah,
the more,
you know,
likely
she came
case.
In and she put on this charlatan holding up her own business model by, you know, making Japan look good, and our warriors are honorable.
That's amazing. That's another layer in all of these layers. Like, you even have to take this one story and break it down in terms of truth. There's two potential truths.
As the stories go on and on, they become more layered and nuanced. And then we get to the final story, which is the woodcutter who had lied previously to avoid involving himself in this trial. And even he has conflicting reasons for, you know, I think he stole the dagger? Yes, I think he stole the dagger because he has six children
right.
to feed. And
he wanted to stab them all with that dagger.
That's what I would have done.
To get rid of them.
But yeah, he saw what he claims really happened, but I think
I feel like
that with a grain of salt as well.
I feel like of all the stories, his is probably the closest to accurate, but again, it's still, you know.
Yes, it's tinged with his self-interest
right.
as well. He lies at the end saying that, you know, he never comes out and says he took the dagger.
Right.
Someone just asks, well, what about the dagger?
Yeah,
it's strange because you don't know who, because there's no real through line to the stories. I mean, in all of them, they fight
right.
and he dies.
Right. And she's raped, they fight,
yeah.
and the samurai's murdered.
Like, the only thing that is a fact in all the stories is that the samurai is dead. That's the only fact in all the stories.
And the wife was raped.
Right.
There was a rape and a murder. And there's really nothing worse to happen to you as a human being than either being raped or murdered.
Right.
You're either having your intimacy stolen from you or your life stolen from you. There's nothing worse.
I mean, sometimes Dave's jokes are worse.
You're right. You're right. These characters could have been sitting in on one of our podcasts.
Oh, I pity them then.
And then there's the interesting fact that the film never tells you what happens to the bandit and the wife. Like,
yeah, like what?
You never see the judgment.
Yeah,
laid
there's no
out.
Verdict.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great. You're left to make the verdict yourself, which is what we're doing here today.
I loved the
guilty
of being a great movie.
Of all the stories besides the ghost one, I like the woodcutter one the most. Just I like in that one how pathetic pretty much everyone is
yes.
in that one. I like that after the bandit rapes the samurai's wife, he's just regretful. Like, he feels bad about
yeah,
it.
Feels
like,
shame.
Yeah.
And this great warrior samurai and this nefarious bandit fight like two boobs.
Yes.
Yeah, the woodcutter's story is great because everyone involved, their egos are removed from
yeah.
it. So
he's like a... Of all the people telling a story, he's the one who's the most removed from...
Yeah.
He's like a disinterested yeah. third party,
which
basically.
Makes him the most reliable, but he's still unreliable.
Yeah,
so
still
I don't put any faith in his story over any of the other characters,
yeah.
really.
But it makes all the characters look the best.
Yeah.
Even
yeah.
though...
By making them look the worst. Like,
yeah.
the fact that they're the most pathetic in that story makes them more sympathetic.
Because they kind of stop being archetypes. And
they
become more
as the film goes on, these characters become more human through each tale each version of the story that's told,
but that's
incredible.
But I would argue in the individual stories, the woman is always just a woman,
right?
And the samurai is always just a samurai, unless it's his version,
right.
You know what I mean? But in that story, they're all
fully fledged.
They all take on their individual characteristics.
And during the framing device, the priest and the woodcutter just keep saying over and over, "This is a terrible story we have to tell you.
It's horrendous."
It's just and I'm like, are we going to get on with this? Are you going to tell me? We only have 86 minutes left.
I've never heard a story like this.
But it lives up to what they're building the story up to be.
Yeah.
It's truly a terrible, terrible story.
Yeah,
I was trying to put it in a modern context. And has anything like that been done, like a Rashomon remake?
There was an American
a Paul Newman movie.
Yeah,
it's abysmal.
Yeah, it's not
is
very
it bad.
Good.
Yeah, yeah. It's got a 21% on Rotten Tomatoes last I checked.
Oh, all right. I felt like this could be done well if in the right hands.
I mean, other films borrow from aspects of this time and more. Like, Usual Suspects uses it.
Yeah.
Like I said, Law and Order uses it every single episode.
There's a movie called Basic with John Travolta and Samuel Jackson.
That's a steaming turd.
That movie is terrible, but it's literally, it's like the same concept of this.
Yeah, that's a terrible movie.
Oh, that's bad.
But yeah, that's pretty much the most faithful to this storytelling style.
Of the framing device, the one thing I really liked is that it's the priest and the woodcutter. They're telling the story, and the third guy is just listening.
Yeah,
the whole thing, he's sort of just like an asshole. And I like at the end, he's the one who's most put off by everything. And he's like, "I'm fucking leaving."
Yeah,
like because the whole story, he just seems like the most jaded. Where he's like, "I want to hear your salacious story," but at the end, even he can't. Like he's like, "I've had enough of this whole thing."
Yes, and he steals from a baby.
Yes,
who wouldn't?
What did you guys think of the baby thing? I feel like that's the only thing I didn't like. I just feel like
I found it entirely unnecessary.
Yeah, it's more like
it's a little maudlin. Like,
yeah. It's more like it's not that it doesn't work. It's that I feel like they could have found a better way to wrap everything up than just like, oh, there's a baby.
It's almost a Deus Ex Machina.
Right.
Almost. I do like that the fact that the sun's out at the very end was an accident. Kurosawa wanted it to be downpouring still at the end of the film.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's one of the most famous like accidents in film. They were waiting and waiting and waiting for a rainy day, and they just ran out of production money. And it was like, forget it, just film it in the sunny, beautiful sunny day. So, the original way the story would have ended is, yes, the woodcutter would have taken the baby, adopted it as his own, but it would still be a cloudy, rainy day, which would, you know, cast everything in shadow, which would mean that he was doing this on an impulse, and it's still a selfish act.
He's doing it to make himself feel better
for stealing the dagger and not intervening in the trial.
And that ending,
and I like that a whole lot more.
And that hints at like the Japan, like we still need to rebuild this. Like it's not, the work's not done. The sunshine and happiness. It's like, oh, everything's better now.
And Kurosawa did not want to end the film on a happy note like that, but that's the film we have.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I like the film.
In that case, it's terrible.
Yeah, well.
Let's get rid of it.
This is more gripe than grape.
As far as shots go, those courtyard shots with the two, like the priest and
how they're always in the background. Yeah, I love
beautiful
that.
Framing. Beautiful God. Framing. Yes, just to paint a picture, if you haven't seen this film, I don't know what you're doing listening to this podcast.
You're very confused right now.
But in the courtroom setting, the person testifying.
Order
in the court. Dave's out of order. So the person testifying is sitting up front and center, and the priest and the woodcutter are, or whoever's not testifying, are sitting in the very back right of the shot. Right.
Not even just sit, they're literally on the ground kneeling, basically.
Yeah, they're sitting like
crisscross applesauce is what they call it.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's this gorgeous symmetry of ideas that are hiding behind the surface of the front of the film. It's just incredible. It's brilliant.
I like that. And it's all, it like has that conscience over your shoulder kind of.
Yes. Yes.
Thing going on too. There's something brilliant about that. And we said it before, but the fact that you never see the judge. It's just you, like Chris said, it's just you. Yeah.
Not just see, you never hear. I love that technique where basically the character just repeats what the judge is saying because you don't hear what they're saying.
Yeah. It's wonderful.
They're talking to you. It's like it's almost like they're reading your thoughts.
Or they're talking to a jury of their peers, and that's us.
Which ends up being like a phenomenal use of voiceover narrative because you're hearing a testimony.
It's a clever way of doing voiceover without just there. Like, oh.
Yeah. It really, everything about this is smart. It's artistic. It's beautiful.
And it definitely is, to borrow from the Kurosawa biography, it very is westernized. Even though this is a foreign film, this is the most American foreign film I've ever seen.
Kurosawa is compared to John Ford a lot, which I don't know if that's fair to compare them just because they do Western.
The guy who makes the cars?
Nope, that was Henry Ford. Okay.
Different Ford.
Yeah. He was the terrible racist.
But yeah, he's compared to John Ford because they did a lot of Western films that around that time, the 50s.
Right.
But, like Wild West?
Yes, like Wild West. Yes. Exactly like Wild West. But yeah, this is a very westernized film, and it was a bomb in Japan. That's a horrendous pun.
They just didn't.
Could we edit that out?
We're leaving it in.
But yeah, like when the Japanese critics, they did not like this, and when it became so popular, they didn't understand it in America. They were like, why did the Americans like?
They just
this
thought
so
it, that we liked it because it was exotic.
Yeah,
like, yeah.
It couldn't be any less exotic.
Right.
This is such an Americanized movie.
And the critics at that time were very traditional. They were very about portrayals of Japan.
I believe they were those two old men Muppets up in the box.
Stadler and Waldorf.
Yes, that's who they were.
They tried submitting this to Venice as Japan's selection because usually a country can only send one, at least back then. During
the Venice Film Festival.
Yeah, the Venice Film Festival. They weren't just sending it to the city.
Yeah, here you go.
Throwing it in the water.
This will solve all your problems.
And the Japanese government was like, oh, no, wouldn't you rather have this movie? It's much more Japanese. And they're like, we'll
take the good one.
Yeah,
then it ended up winning the Golden Lion, which is like the biggest prize at Venice.
Yeah, and it should have. This is an incredible movie. I think it's a great starting point for Kurosawa, for people to watch Kurosawa.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
This is the absolute jumping off point. And you can take it any way you want. You can take it everything as surface. Because it's just an enjoyable. If you like Law and Order episodes, watch this movie. You'll like it.
Yeah, that is true.
Or you can take it. You can look at it a step further. Look beneath the surface. See all the imagery that Kurosawa uses. Right. You can appreciate it for the gorgeous cinematography. There's a whole lot going on in this film that came out in 1950 that really most films were not interested
in doing.
If
you love Tarantino, like within the first 10 minutes, you get the vibe of Tarantino.
Yeah.
The dialogue is very, it's delivered and
he cited this film as inspiration for, you know, Django, Kill Bill volumes 1 and 2. And that's not to get into Tarantino too much, but that's one of the problems I have with Tarantino is not that he makes movies that are derivative of stuff before, because he is the first one to tell you I was ripping off this and this. But people who love Tarantino will say, oh, did you see Kill Bill? It's amazing. But they'll never go the extra step to watch all the films that Tarantino himself said, this is what went into the making of Kill Bill.
Right.
But this doesn't...
So their knowledge ends at Tarantino, and that's unfair to the amazing films that he...
Yeah, that's true. That is annoying.
...built his body of work off of.
These never feel... Or Tarantino's movies don't feel like they're ripping this off. They just feel like a delivery system for those, you know what I mean? He's like popping.
That's why Tarantino is a master. He's an incredible director, because not only does he have great taste in his the films that he's cribbing from, but he also has his own unique spin that he puts on.
Yeah.
But you've been listening to the Tarantino cast.
Yeah, thanks.
Sorry to derail everything, but yeah, Rashomon, this is a great movie.
Yeah, I don't imagine why you wouldn't like this movie unless you're one of those complete assholes who says, oh, I don't like black and white movies and I don't like subtitles, in which case, put your fucking head in the oven because I'm sick of you.
Do yourself a favor, watch this movie if you haven't already.
Perhaps you don't like the gender politics in the film.
Oh, get out of here. But we won't go into that, but I don't know. Some people, they have this weird sort of aversion to black and white films and subtitle
films.
And, I mean, I get it on some levels because it, you know, a film that subtitles, it requires more attention than, you know, you can't like look at your phone because you're gonna miss what the hell anyone's saying unless you speak the language.
You're doing yourself a tremendous disservice if you don't watch this movie.
It's just
a lot of bad like Asian bad cinema that is like,
you're like all that tentacle porn.
Yes.
No. Like,
he said bad, Chris.
I'm sorry. I thought you said,
you know,
great.
What I mean? like ninja movies where it's like just people chopping each other's heads off and stuff. Like, you don't and that has an appeal to certain people, but this is it. So I could see why you might just see this and be like, oh, it's one of those.
But no, this is
not
a film.
This is a real movie.
But and I mean, you could say that about American films. If you seen the Expendables movies, you would say, "Oh, American films are just about blowing people up and this Dolph Lundgren's chin."
Well, in the end, isn't that what all films are
about? Yeah, I was saying from like an id American.
We'll get there one day, Chris. So yeah, this is a great movie, Kurosawa. I'm excited to watch our next film in the series. Yes. What is it?
It is Seven Samurai, which is
four hours.
Short.
Oh.
We only have a week to watch it. I'm not sure if it'll be enough.
Yeah, especially Dave, who watches all the films an hour before the show starts.
Yeah, that might be a longer podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, there's two. There's an American cut of Seven Samurai, which is 140 minutes, but we're purists here, so we're going to be doing the full 2 hour and or is it three? Is it
three?
Three?
Yeah, three.
It's 3 hour and 10 days long. Seven Samurai, which of course is probably one of Kurosawa's even more influential films, because inspired remakes like The Magnificent Seven, and so.
Yeah, so if you want to watch that before the podcast next week, this is your warning.
Yeah, you can check.
Don't you dare do it. We'd like to spoil it for you.
It's probably, is it on Hulu because of the Criterion?
It's on Hula Hoop.
Okay.
If you hula hoop fast enough, you'll see this film.
That seems unlikely, but I want you to try it.
All right, so you guys want to rec or yeah, let's recommend some movies.
I want to rec.
I think I'm turning Cupid film. I really think so.
Wow. Boy. Can we go back in time and strike that?
Play it again? Yes. Yes, we can.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Who wants to go first?
Not me.
Dave, you want to go first?
No.
How about Dave?
I have to pick a movie first.
All right. I'll go first then.
Go for it.
I am going to pick a 2003 film that I saw on Netflix this week. It's a thriller. It's an Italian film. Is it called the Thriller in Manila? I'm Not Scared is what it's called, Dave. And this is, it takes place in the 70s, and it's loosely based on real life events that happened during the 70s. There were a wave of children being kidnapped from wealthy families by, you know, bad guys.
Yes.
So, oh, no.
Ruffians.
Yes. Bandits. This is it's about a young boy who accidentally discovers a deep hole in the ground where another boy is chained prisoner. Hidden from the world.
I mean, we've all been there.
Of course. Who hasn't? And this is a really, really, really unsettling film, and it's great. It's a crime drama. It's a foreign film, obviously. It takes place in the 70s. It's everything I love about a movie.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it really captures youth in a authentic light. This boy finds another boy, but he's afraid to tell anybody, so... You know, he starts bringing him food and water, but he's you know, like I said, he's afraid of what might happen if he tells an adult that he found this boy chained underground.
I've heard good things. I've always meant to watch this.
It's
I never did.
Terrific. This is a really good movie.
Original.
It is. It's
yeah.
It's excellent. I loved it. So yeah, that's my pick. 2003's I'm Not Scared. It's available on Netflix.
Jeff, were Jeff, were you scared when you watched it?
No.
Oh. I'll go.
Sure thing, Chris.
Give Dave some more time to find.
I found one.
All right. My pick is a film from 2002. It is called Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. It's written by Charlie Kaufman, who wrote, you know, Being John Malkovich and Adaptation, all those quirky, weird films.
Eternal Sunshine.
Yes, he did write that. And this is directed by George Clooney. I believe it was his directorial debut. And it's based on the true story of game show host Chuck Barris. He hosted a show called The Gong Show. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a book called Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, where he claimed that while he was a TV game show host, he was also a hitman for the CIA. And so that's what this film is about. And the book is obviously not true, but the film presented as it really happened, that while he was hosting all these kitschy sort of 70s game shows, he was also traveling around the world murdering people for the CIA. And
so he's a cuckoo bird.
Yes.
Okay.
And Sam Rockwell plays Chuck Barris, and Sam Rockwell is one of those, I feel like, just underrated great sort of character
actors.
Sort
of like the Ben Mendelsohn.
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
Of the early 2000s.
Yeah, he's always good in whatever he's doing, and he's great in this, at playing this sort of kooky sort of guy.
Yeah, he's like the Men Bendelsohn of the year.
Man, I hate your guts. And this it's a comedy, but this film
Ooh. Is this good though? Like I've seen this.
Oh, it's great. It's a great
movie. Watching.
It's really well. I mean, this is George Clooney's first job directing, but he does a great job directing it. And the acting, George Clooney's in the film. He plays Chuck Barris' like CIA handler, the guy who recruits him to the CIA, and he's great. And even though it's a comedy, it's very dark, and it's darker than you might expect it to be.
Nice.
And it's sort of tragic in the end. Like, the film ends on this really sour note. I won't spoil it, but it ends on
this. Is it a B-flat?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It ends on the brown note, I believe. So, this is on Netflix. Check it out. It's called Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
He was licking me!
What is that?
That's from Ravenous.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the guy who played...
Oh, yeah. That movie where they eat people.
Yes. Who played Daniel Faraday in Lost.
Yeah, Jeremy Davies is his name.
Hi, I'm Dave.
All right.
Hey, Dave.
I'm going to do one of my favorite things to do on the podcast.
Execute yourself?
Tell
that's
terrible
one of my
jokes.
Favorite things that you do.
Recommend movies you can't see yet.
That's You're a good. Jerk off.
Because I'm so hoity-toity. Yes. Anyway, I want to recommend a film to you that I saw a few weeks ago that comes out next Friday. So maybe you'll get all pumped up and you'll be like, I'm going to the movies because Dave recommended it.
I
hope so.
Yeah.
It's called True Story. It stars James Franco and Jonah Hill.
Oh,
and
yes.
It is not a comedy.
What?
It is actually a drama.
Oh.
And, I don't believe this.
It tells the story of Christian Longo, who murdered his entire family one day.
Are you sure it's not a comedy?
No, it is not.
Oh.
It's very strange. It starts out, you don't really know. I knew nothing about this story.
Right.
So I kind of won't tell you too much about the story itself, but James Franco's character killed his family and he's hiding out in Mexico using the name of a New York Times reporter, Michael Finkel, played by Jonah Hill, who at the time of Christian Longo getting captured, you know, by the feds and being transported back to America, Michael Finkel had this whole drama where he had a cover story for the New York Times, which had some, you know, loose facts in it. So he was fired and he had moved back to live with his wife in like Minnesota or something. And he just gets contacted to comment about this story and he didn't even know about it. So he goes... he's seeing it as an opportunity to get some, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Some credibility back. He wants to write a story about this guy, Christian Longo, because the guy's kind of obsessed with him. So he gets access that you wouldn't normally have to a guy who's on trial for murder. Usually the press lawyers make you stay away from the press.
Right.
It's very the dynamic between Franco and. What's his name? Jonah Hill in this is it's amazing to me that they're the same guys in those crazy movies. Jonah Hill, although he's played dramatic roles in Wolf of Wall Street, that was kind of a
Moneyball.
Moneyball is less comedic, but this is something totally different. He's like a selfish character. Like, you don't really root for this character. It's a very weird movie, but it reminded me a lot of HBO's The Jinx series.
Oh, okay.
And I had seen this right at the same time that was on, and they even like in the way the movie looks, because there's a lot of this like courtroom Rashomon type stuff where he's telling the story of what happened and it's not actually the story of what happened. You don't see like faces. That was like something they did a lot in The Jinx, because it was reenactments, you know what I mean?
A lot of,
So this is great.
It's similar to The Jinx.
Yeah, it's eerily similar to The Jinx.
What about the MTV's The Max? Is it anything similar to that?
What about The Noid? Is it Ruin Pizzas?
It's a lot like HBO's The Spawn cartoon.
Oh, oh, good. I was hoping we could have a modern day Spawn.
Yeah, this does sound interesting. So
I don't know if you like, because you guys, you don't like Franco, both of you, as much as I do. But I'm curious
that he was a murderer, Dave. Terrible man.
I'm very Not the dictator.
Oh, I misunderstood you.
I want to know what you guys think of this movie, because I love both of these guys, Jonah Hill. So maybe I'm just looking through rose-colored glasses.
Perhaps.
All right. Find out next week.
Yeah. What's it called?
True Story.
All right.
Whoa. Well. Turn that piano down.
That's okay. Our show, and we're sticking to it.
Yes. That's it, everybody. Again, we are the Cut Print Film Podcast.
You can find the best motherfucking podcast on the internet.
Wow. Boy, I'm glad you interjected that.
Yeah.
Cutprintfilm.com. That's where you can find this podcast, all our movie reviews, all our editorials, interviews with actors and directors, news, up-to-date news every single day.
The best news on the internet.
Yes, I don't know about that.
You can't find better news than on cutprintfilm.com.
Also, we're on Twitter, @cutprintfilm. We're on Facebook, whatever that is. We're on other stuff.
Stitcher. But here's the big
we're
takeaway.
Killing it.
Yeah, here's the big takeaway. Give us a great review on iTunes, and we'll give you a hickey.
Yeah, even if you don't mean it, just go. Go ahead.
We won't mean it either. It'll be an empty hickey.
Here's the big takeaway. Dyfus, they're taking away your children.
Yes. Oh, my God.
If you don't give us a good review, Dyfus is coming, and they're taking away your firstborn.
We're going to report you immediately.
So, all right, next week on the cutprintfilm.com, you can expect reviews from the film Dave just talked about, True Story.
It's a rave review.
Oh, boy. I wonder if it'll be good or bad. Oh, he already spilled the beans. Child 44 comes out, the new Tom Hardy film.
Nope.
I don't think we'll have a review.
No, it's not screening for anyone, nope. So it's probably a stinker.
I'm going to try to see that.
Paul Blart 2, Mall Cop.
Nope, we 2. Won't have that, no.
That comes out. We probably won't have a review for that because they're not screening it for critics.
Yeah.
We will have Ex Machina, though.
Yes, Ex Machina comes out.
A lot of stuff.
A lot of great stuff. Ex Machina actually came out last week, but we'll have a review next week.
Yes, because we live in a third market.
Yes, last week's movies reviewed this week.
Yes.
That's our motto.
It's the best city in the country.
Yes.
So, yeah, who else can you listen to, everyone?
Joystick Jerks.
Oh, yes.
The podcast. They do a video game podcast. You can find them over at joystickjerks.com. Very funny show.
Joystick Jerks. They jerk the joy, so you don't have to.
Well, you could still jerk the joy if you wanted to.
Boy.
Even though they've done it prior to you. Who else can you listen to,
Speaking
Dave?
Speaking of jerking the joy, you can listen to antifanboy.com. They have a podcast about all sorts of pop culture stuff. Comic books, video games, movies, you name it, they got it.
Yes, and antifanboy.com. You can find all sorts of news about all those different topics that
we just named.
Yeah. And you can listen to our podcast, but you're already doing that.
I hope so. They've probably fled the room in terror by now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's our show, guys.
Yeah.
Have a good night. Or day. Whatever. I don't really care when you're listening to
Whenever
this.
Whenever the hell you listen to this.
Maybe they're sleeping.
That's weird.
And it's the middle of the night. And right now, they're going to wake up! All right, that work?